The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Yeah. All right, we continue our series of BS reports from the Sloan Conference in Boston, Massachusetts, my favorite city on the planet. Eric Mangini, now of ESPN, joining us. We get along now, the two of us.
I didn't know we didn't get along.
It might have been one-sided, yeah. But we're all good now. Okay. So you just finished your first full season as an ESPN person, talking head, personality. What'd you think?
There's some things I really liked and some things that were hard to talk about in terms of the hypotheticals of hypotheticals.
Yeah.
Where they say, well, if this were to happen and then this were to happen, where do you think this player should go?
Right.
Or any of those different scenarios. And to me, it's probably never going to happen. You know, there's no real... I understand why it's interesting. It's just hard to provide a meaningful context to those types of...
Because sports fans love hypotheticals.
No, I get that, and coaches hate them.
Yeah.
So it's... I appreciate why they're being asked, but that's one of the things that's been a little tougher for me, I think.
Yeah. Well, I know from my vantage point, the first time I saw you on one of the shows, and I was like, this guy's not bad. And then I was watching more, and I was like, this guy's pretty good. And then watch more, and I'm like, this guy's solid. Like, I was surprised. Is it almost like insulting that people, that somebody would be surprised you'd be good on TV? I feel like that's insulting.
Well, it is in the sense, but I took a pretty serious beating in terms of how I was, I think, perceived from a public standpoint.
As being the coach who's,
Because I didn't share a lot of information. And,
right.
And look, I went from New England where I had done one press conference ever when I was defense coordinator, and it was in the middle of August. There's about six people there, and they really weren't that interested in what I had to say. It was before there's mandatory coordinator press conferences to being the head coach of the Jets.
Yeah.
And my first press conference there's 100, 150 people there, 20 cameras, and it's like having kids. You tend to do what your parents taught you to do, or, you know, you saw as you were being raised. And my football parents were Bill Parcells and Bill Belichick, and there was a way that those things were approached, and that's kind of what you learn, and it's a little bit of who are you to feel like you can do it better than they did it, or you're going to have a better rationale than they did it. But what I learned over time is that you just got to do it the way that's right for you. And I think I got to that later in New York and in Cleveland, but after... There's a perception. It's much harder to overcome that perception, you know, even if you have change.
It does seem like we always forget there's such a giant learning curve with a coach, you know, and you look at what happened with Belichick in Cleveland. The Cleveland fans still hate him and think that he sucks, even though he's won three Super Bowls. And you go to that second team, you learn from all your mistakes with the first team. It actually felt like with the Browns, I'm old, I might be forgetting this, but wasn't that team kind of playing well in your last year?
Well, I thought we played well in both years in spurts, and it's like anything else. You go in with a plan, and your plan isn't a two-year plan.
Yeah.
You know, it's a longer-term plan, and when you talk about things and you make decisions, you want to make good organizational decisions that are going to set you up to be competitive year in and year out.
Yeah.
But people want it, you know, they want you to cook a turkey, but they want you to cook it in a microwave. And it doesn't work like that. Like, you have to, you've got to have the time to put things in place. And with any new situation, it's going to be bumpy. And you either deal with the criticism and you deal with the down times in order to set yourself up for long-term future success, or you say, hey, we're just going to sell out everything this year to try to win right now.
Yeah.
But oftentimes, it's not sustainable. It's not a sustainable model.
Was it a bad thing that you got that job that early? Like, in retrospect, do you wish you had stayed like an extra year with the Patriots and then maybe do you feel like it was too soon for you?
I don't know, because I don't think that anybody...
Like, how old were you?
I was 34, I think.
I guess that's a fair age.
Yeah, at the time, I was the third youngest ever, I believe.
But tough city to be 34-year-old first-time coach.
Yeah, it's tough being a first-time coach, regardless of what city you're in, because there's no manual. They don't give you a head coaching manual. You're not trained on how to be a head coach, and things come up. I remember sitting in that chair and thinking, oh, okay, now I see why Bill did this.
Yeah.
Okay, now I see why Bill Parcells did this. Whereas an assistant, you're thinking, what are they doing? Why are they doing this? It made no sense, and it did when I was there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, okay. And there's always five things that come up in the course of the day that you don't plan for. So you go in with your schedule, and this is what you want to achieve on that day, but something comes up that you're just like, I've never dealt with this.
Yeah.
I have no idea what to do here.
In Cleveland, you didn't really have a quarterback that was, I would say, above average. The Jets, I'm trying to remember, Pennington?
Yeah, I think Chad
played pretty well that year for you.
And, you know, what we did with Brett Favre is it was one of those situations where we agreed, myself and Mike and Woody, that we were going to bring Brett in, and we understood that it was a short-term answer. We were on the verge of opening up a new stadium, and the concept was take a shot, and at the end of the year, it, you know, we'd see where we are, but we were going to continue with the plan.
Yeah.
And we went 8-2 or 8-3, whatever it was, and unfortunately, Brett's arm got dinged up, and we weren't quite the same at the end of the year. And it's like anything else, you may have a certain plan at the beginning of the season, but at the end of the year, when you're 8-3 at one point, you know, someone has to go.
Did you find yourself rooting against the Jets the following year? I would have done that. I'm hugely spiteful, though. I definitely would have been like, screw those guys.
This is the tough part of that, is a lot of those coaches stayed.
Yeah.
A lot of the people in, whether it was the medical staff or the scouting staff or PR, were people that I was part of hiring.
And you felt like you had built the foundation.
The players we brought in were all guys that I cared about. Mm. So do you want them to be successful after you leave? You know, human nature is no. But then there's a bunch of people that you really like.
Yeah.
And you really want to see, especially the players, well, the coaches too, but it's like these are young guys that you brought in, that you developed to see them, you know, blossom, like Darrell Revis, Nick Mangold, DeBrickshaw Ferguson, those guys that it's like, all right, this is great to see.
If I was your buddy, I probably would have said, dude, you're going with the Jets, one of the most tortured fan bases on the planet. And then it's like, hey, it's the Browns. There's the most tortured sports city on the planet. Like, kind of feels like your next job should be like Jacksonville or somewhere where there's like, you just leave you alone for a couple of years and let you do your thing.
Well, what you don't want to do is be the cleaner where you walk into, some, you know, the guy from Pulp Fiction who comes in and takes care of all those problems.
Yeah.
And where you go in, you say, okay, well, the salary cap, you've got a problem there. And the
building. That's what happened to you in Cleveland.
The building needs to be revamped.
Yeah.
You know, there's problem guys there. And
yeah.
You say, okay, we're going to take these hits. And believe me, it's not popular, but if there's consensus that we're going to live through this together to get to a better place,
yeah,
then it's easier to make those decisions. But if that plan changes, it gets
or
a little...
Or somebody new comes in who may take over and decide he wants this instead of that. And
yeah, it gets harder. But I really believe in the things that we did. And,
yeah.
And one of it was a commitment to a certain type of player.
Yeah.
And guys, you know, the media's heard me say it 1,000 times, but I believe in this. And I learned this in Cleveland first, when I was with Belichick there. I was in the locker room when they signed Andre Rison. I picked Andre Rison up from the airport, you know, because that was my, you know, was my role in life. And so he was going to sign a contract and get a $5 million signing bonus. And we're sitting in the limo, and there's a press conference scheduled. And we sat in that limo for an hour, and he didn't come inside. I'm like, Andre, we got to go. And made everybody wait, and it didn't work out, and the locker room imploded because players look at, okay, this is who you paid. That's what you value.
Right.
Then we go to New England, and we put an emphasis on character guys. And even in New York with Bill Parcells, the guys we brought in, character guys, and it's truth in sports. You know, you get a bunch of selfless guys who don't care about who gets the credit that work together, you can do great things.
So all the things you believed in before you took your first coaching job, it sounds like you believe in them even more now that you've had the course that you've had with the two teams and saw what worked and didn't work.
I know it works.
Is that right?
Because I see it every single year. It works where a player comes out who's got great potential. Why aren't, you know, you should definitely take this player who's got great potential. He's got great potential. Guy comes in the league, he doesn't do anything, and everybody wonders, why didn't he do anything? Because he didn't have the character to back up that potential. Then you bring in these other guys that have great intrinsic motivation and character, and suddenly average becomes good, good becomes great, and great becomes a Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
I mean, Tom Brady wasn't...
Yeah, he's 5'8". He can't play in this league, but he gives a crap.
But it's even Tom Brady. Yeah. Everybody knows Tom Brady now.
Right.
But Tom Brady wasn't Tom Brady when we got him. He was a skinny six-round draft pick, and we do these post-practice workouts where... No, he struggled.
Yeah.
But he worked, and he had character, and he showed leadership.
So you saw that even when he was like backup dude.
Yeah, that's why there was that belief in him, and that's why he was given time. We carried four quarterbacks that first year he was there.
Yeah.
And, you know, but you just think like, oh, of course, it's Tom Brady. Well, part of what makes Tom Brady great is who he is.
Yeah.
And he worked, and even now... And I'll say this about Bill Belichick, too, is regardless of how much success either of those guys had, they work at the same level. They weren't affected by the fame, the success. They come in and they work at the same level, you know, all the time.
The Patriots won three Super Bowls with the Belichick-Brady combo. Do you think that was the right amount? Should they have won more?
Well, they've been to two more. They've been to another AFC Championship
game. I kind of feel like you can make a case they could have won seven. Or you could make a case they could have won two. I think the 03, 04 ones were the best teams those years. I don't think there's any doubt. 01, a couple breaks go in that Rams game. Maybe they don't win that.
01, we weren't the most talented team.
No.
But we were the best team. That's the difference.
Yeah.
And that, to me, that experience there solidified my belief system in building a team and drafting players and bringing players in free agency more than any other experience that I've had in sports, because that's what it is, especially in football. It's about the team concept. And whatever book you read on the Patriots, whatever you hear about the Patriots, the way the players talk, they talk in terms of team, and it's not just rhetoric.
Right.
It's a belief system.
And that, I mean, you could say they had the belief system was much stronger from 01 to 04 than maybe what guys start to leave, like, do you realize that as it's happening, or do you realize that after the fact? Like, oh, crap, we don't have as many of those guys as we had before. Like, Willie leaves, and, you know, all of a sudden there's a tipping point, right?
Yeah, see, I don't know a lot about all the new guys that are there. I think they have one.
Well, I'm talking about mid-2000s.
Yeah,
you know?
But we won again in 2004.
Right.
And then we went to
was Denver.
Went to the playoffs.
Which was a stupid loss. I still feel like if we played Denver, I use Wee Lick, I'm on the team. If we played Denver 10 times that year, I think we win 6.
Yeah, and we had 5 turnovers. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that
everything went wrong in that game that could go wrong.
Yeah.
And then the Colts game, in my opinion, was a worse loss than the Super Bowl of the Giants. Because to be at 21-3, it just...
Think about how you're talking, though. Talking about, oh, that AFC Championship game, that was the worst loss.
I know.
The loss after the 16-0 season, that was horrible. There's a lot of teams that would trade places.
Oh, yeah.
For the level of success over time that...
That's why the fans in Cleveland right now are swearing at me as they listen to this podcast. Like, are you really bitching about the AFC Championship game, Simmons? But, hey, it's like...
It's a high...
There's probably 5 plays that could have swung another 3 Super Bowls. Like, even that Giants game, like... The now infamous Welker pass.
Yeah, but those are high class problems.
Yeah,
those are high class problems.
Yeah, that's true. That's what. When you watched that Super Bowl, did you feel like the right team won? Super Bowl 46.
I don't know. It's hard each game because of all the Super Bowls that I was a part of.
Yeah,
they swing on about 5 plays.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And that's a handful of plays that swing a game. And Marty Schottenheimer told me that a long time ago. He's like, look, Eric, every game is going to swing on five plays. So it could have gone either way. It easily could have gone either way.
Well, I wrote this a couple weeks ago. This was a really weird season in that I feel like the Patriots could have won the Super Bowl. Absolutely, a couple plays ago. Ravens. Evans just cradles it. Now they're in the Super Bowl. Who knows with them?
Niners. Who knows if the field goal is successful? What happens after that?
Oh, yeah, true. You know? Niners. Mm-hmm. Guy doesn't touch the punt or fumble the other one. Maybe Eli finally makes a mistake in overtime, whatever. They were right there. The Saints were right there. And the Packers had one of those games like the 05 Broncos-Patriot game where it's just everything went wrong in that game for them. And the Giants gained momentum. But it did feel like six teams could have potentially won with some breaks this year. Maybe that's what the league is now.
I remember in 2001, okay, David, we're playing Buffalo. And I believe it was overtime.
So I know what you're going to say, the helmet.
David Patton gets knocked out.
Yeah.
His helmet's out of bounds. His foot's touching the ball. I mean, sometimes just breaks your way.
I can't remember.
The snowball, the tuck rule.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes those things just break your way.
Somebody was telling me, I can't remember where I heard this. Can't remember. They were saying that at some point during one of those seasons, you know, and the whole team gets confidence, like, this is happening for us. Like, we can feel it. And you just start to feel like every break can go your way. And it didn't feel like that happened in 2001 to some degree.
Well, during that run, you'd sit there in the fourth quarter, and there was never a sense of panic. It didn't matter whether you're behind or not behind, because you were going to win.
Yep.
Because that's what's supposed to happen.
Right.
And you just, it was just understood. Everybody just went back to the bench, said, okay, this is where we are now. This is what we have to do, but we're going to win. And that confidence is a tremendous, tremendous asset.
So where does it go? You lose one tough game and it just vanishes?
No, I don't think it's one tough game. It's the same thing with losing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you're ahead in the fourth quarter, and if your team isn't used to winning, there's almost that mentality of, when's the other shoe going to drop?
Yep.
What bad thing is going to happen here, as opposed to saying, no, this is going to happen. We are going to make this happen. And it's to say what the tipping point is either way, I don't think anybody's ever identified that. But when you have it one way or the other,
you know it as it's happening.
You can feel it.
Yeah,
you can feel it.
So the Browns right now are a really interesting spot. I think they have the fourth pick. They've needed a quarterback since forever, since Bernie Kosar. I can't even remember the last great quarterback. They could trade up two spots and pay a king's ransom and get Robert Griffin III, who would be instantly the first signature guy that team's had in forever. Would you do that if you were them? Do they need somebody like that?
Here's what I'll say about these questions is, if you feel that Robert Griffin III is a franchise quarterback, which means each year he's going to give you a chance to compete for a Super Bowl, then there's no price too expensive to pay for that guy.
I totally agree.
Okay. Now, if you're wrong, it is the last quarterback you are ever drafting. That's what it is. You go all in. Because if you're right, you're going to be there a long time. He's going to win a ton of games. And if you're wrong, he's going to outlive you, and the next coaching staff will coach him, and the next GM.
So it's World Series of Poker, and you're just going.
Yeah.
That's it. That's your move.
And I didn't realize this at the time when we brought in Brett Favre and signed as many free agents as we did. That's what we were doing. That's what I was doing.
In a roundabout way. Yeah.
You just slide your chips in and you go all in. And that's the reality of it. But there's this assumption that Robert Griffin III, and I'm not knocking Robert Griffin III.
Yeah.
I'm just saying there's this assumption that he's going to be the next great quarterback. But there's an assumption that Sam Bradford was going to be the next great quarterback. And he still might be. But right now, he's done some good things, but it's not like he's elevated that franchise, to great heights. And every year, Ryan Leaf, DeMarcus Russell, the league is littered with them. So it's nice to think that just add this player and we'll be great, but it's not a guarantee.
Here would be my counter to that, because I think Griffin is going to be a huge star.
Would you bet your job on him?
I think I would, and here's why.
Because if you were making that decision, you would be.
I would do it.
Okay.
I would do it, and here's why. I think the way the league is going, I think that kind of quarterback is just the biggest advantage you can have. If you have somebody that, you know, in the old days, if you had a quarterback that ran around, that you get physical with that guy and you take shots at him after. Like, now it's like those guys just don't, if they can move around and avoid that kind of punishment, you know you're getting 16 games a year out of him. You know he can create plays with his legs.
Yes and no. Because sometimes those guys that move around get hit a lot
hit
more.
7 yards down the line.
And
scrimmage.
Michael Vick has missed a lot of games, and there's been a lot of mobile quarterbacks over time that do great things with their legs and put a lot of pressure on the defense.
Right.
But to me, where those guys are most effective is if they can operate in a conventional sense, everything that they do unconventionally is that much more of a problem to deal with.
And that's what the biggest shocker with Cam was last year.
Well, that's the greatest thing that he did, is because he could operate from the pocket, which made everything else he did so much more special. But if all you can do, if your natural default is to run with the football, and that's your answer to most problems, odds are at some point that it reaches a ceiling.
But I feel like he can do both. Like, to me, Griffin, I know people love comparing Griffin to Newton because they came a year apart and a little bit similar of what they're trying to achieve, but he reminds me, it's a little more Aaron Rodgers-y for me, because I feel like he could stay in the pocket and scamper around when he needs to. But when he scampers, all of a sudden you're running a 4-4-1.
Right, but part of scampering, too, is how well do you make people miss?
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of guys who are straight line fast who can't make people miss and take huge hits. So you need both of those things. It's not just being fast, it's being quick. And I think one of the things that Cam Newton does really well is, especially for a guy his size, is he can make people miss as well as fast.
Yeah. Doesn't star power matter at all with quarterbacks? I feel like it does. There's a certain charisma that a guy has. You don't
buy it. Did Tom Brady have any star power?
But he's got a charisma to him.
Now he does.
You think he had an 0-1? I felt like he had an 0-1.
Do you think anybody else in the world thought that? Got drafted in the sixth round. Does it matter when you're drafting him? No, it matters when they come in, and it's not about the star power. If they're good, they're going to be stars, and that's true in any position. We're going to make them stars. The world is going to make them a star because they're successful. They don't come in necessarily. Them being a star doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be successful.
I knew after the game, Drew gets hurt at the Mo Lewis game. Mm-hmm. I think like either the next week or 2 weeks later, the Pats scored like 45 or some. It was at home.
We beat the Colts. Who were...
It was a blowout game.
Yeah. Now, we had two interceptions for touchdowns.
Tom was good in that game, though. I remember thinking, like, ooh, I like the way this guy carries himself.
You know we scored 3 offensive touchdowns in playoffs that season.
I'm well aware.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's like...
But nobody has a Super Bowl team ever had worse skill position players than that team. Antoine Smith is a running back. Patton. Troy Brown was the only above-average skill position guy in the entire team.
David Patton, I thought David Patton was
pretty
good.
Would you give him above average if he's your number one? He's on the very low end.
But he had outstanding vertical speed, very good change of direction.
What about the tight end?
Oh,
Jermaine Wiggins.
Jermaine Wiggins.
Who caught 40 passes in the snow game.
Right?
Yeah. He got waived the next summer. Nobody even picked him up.
Great hands. Unbelievable hands.
He was unbelievable in the snow game.
Yeah. It's a... I think, again, it goes back to, team. We beat Pittsburgh. We blocked a field goal for a touchdown. Maybe returned a punt. Drew comes back in, throws a touchdown after Tom gets hurt.
Yeah. That was my favorite random part of that whole run, was that Drew, who really had gotten the shaft that season, to no fault of his own, he gets hurt. He's like a life-threatening thing. Tom comes in, wins over the city. Brady versus Bledsoe becomes this thing. And it becomes clear they just got to ride the Brady thing. And Drew was just not a part of anything that was going on. And then he had his moment where he got to save that game. He had the one great throw.
Yeah, I think it was the David Patton in the corner of the end zone.
Yeah, it was a great throw.
Yeah. What was so special about that whole season, again, goes back to what we all think about as little kids with football and the idea that everybody contributes, the selflessness, I remember I'd come in and, guys would be kidding each other about who got in earliest to work out.
Right.
Who hydrated the best. who studied the hardest. And when you've got that, it's special.
Who's the single biggest leader or single best leader that you remember from that whole run? Or how about this? Who's the single best leader you've seen since you've been working in the league?
Wow, that's...
Was there a force of personality guy that overshadowed?
I love Rodney Harrison.
Yeah.
I love Teddy Bruschi. There's so many guys from that team. You know, Seymour, Willie, Tom, Troy. I mean, Troy Brown, okay? I remember when we went to him to play DB, 12 years in the league or whatever it was, and he was going to be a role player, and he approached that with no ego, no concern about his legacy. He was like, well, okay, you know, I'd love to do this. I'd love to help out. Studied.
Yeah.
Played more defensive snaps than offensive snaps that year. Like, when you've got guys like that, Mike Vrabel.
Mike Vrabel.
I mean, I'm sure I'm forgetting guys that, you know, there's so many of them. Otis Smith.
Did you feel like what Belichick did with this year's Patriots team kind of felt like they overachieved a little bit?
Yeah.
Especially when you look at their defense. I mean, you thought, I ran into you, we talked, we hashed out our whole thing. I'd never met you before. We got over our whole thing. And
that was one-sided, though. I had no animosity.
I'm a diehard Patriot fan. What do you want from me?
It's okay.
And you told me, the Ravens are either going to beat the Patriots or come really close.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, what are you talking about? We're going to kill these guys. Like, no. And you listed out these 19 football reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I'm like, you know, I'm like, all right, that now I'm worried because those were like real reasons that, and you were right. I mean, it came like damn close losing. And then the Giants game, same thing. Probably it feels like the weakest Patriots team that came that close of all the ones.
Well, when you look at this team now, and I talked about this a lot in the beginning of the season, they went to a 4-3.
Yeah.
So they've got 10 years in a 34 system, and then you're transitioning to a 43. There's a lot that goes into that because the coaches have reps built up on coaching that defense as well.
Yeah.
And all the players that were there have reps built up on playing that defense. And when you play a different scheme, the answers don't come as quickly. You haven't seen it as many times where when you've coached something for years and years, it's like, okay, they're doing this. Remember, we'd had that in 2004. We fixed it this way. It's that kind of quick fix. So there was going to be growing pains with that no matter what. And there were a lot of injuries. There were a lot of moving parts. There were a lot of new players. You know, Haynes was there, and then he wasn't there.
That was terrible.
Who was the corner that got released early in the season? I mean, there was a lot of flux. And you have to give them credit for what they were able to succeed with all that adversity. Didn't Dan Copen get hurt early?
Yeah.
Nobody talked about that. Like, nope. That's the other thing that you have to appreciate about your team, is that when things happen, nobody sits there and bemoans, oh, we lost our starting center. Oh, we lost this guy that we thought was going to. And that's also the reason why you're given it. You have a chance to compete every year, is because they're not distracted by those things.
Yeah, the freaking Jets fans, they lost Nick Mangold for like a month. Oh, we went over center. It's like, we don't have a center, period. Like, at least you're getting him back.
But it's that component. It's, you know, whether you're on a win streak or a losing streak, it's all the same.
Yeah.
It's a consistent approach because all you can control is that moment. If you're looking back or looking forward, you're not taking care of what you're supposed to take care of. But that's an art. Like, being able to get that many people to think that way, it's really difficult.
The Giants fans that I'm friends with, who I might be breaking up with, I might just need to get rid of all the Giants fans in my life, but I've been saying, like, if we'd had Gronkowski, we'd win the Super Bowl. You know it. We almost beat you without Gronkowski. I went to the game. He could barely get off the line. By the third quarter, they were defending him with Chase. What was the guy's name, the teacher?
Chase Blackburn.
Chase Blackburn. He was a substitute teacher 2 months ago, now defending the guy who just had the best tight end season of all time. Their argument was, well, if Gronkowski was playing, we would have opened it up more. Gilbride coached a terrible game. We ran the ball all the time. We would have aired it out. We would have won 35-31. What happens if Gronkowski plays?
We're getting back into those hypotheticals.
You have to answer.
Gronkowski did play.
He was 40%.
Okay, but you got to give Gronkowski. That's the other thing is you got to give that kid a lot of credit to play on a high ankle sprain like that.
Tough ass dude.
That's hard, and I know he took a lot of heat for the dancing thing afterwards.
Yeah, but it's 23. Cut him some slack.
You got to appreciate what he did, which was really
I totally agree
really hard to do, and. You know,
you could see it in in the first quarter is okay, but then obviously, and then by the third quarter, he was just could not get off the line.
But it's like anything else. There's going to be injuries
all
throughout the playoffs, and every team could go back and say, "Hey, well, if this guy played, or this guy played, or if you know." I'm sure what they were talking about is it is what it is.
If Victor Cruz had a high ankle sprain, I bet they don't win the Super Bowl.
From UMass.
UMass's own Victor Cruz.
And James Ahedebu.
The other thing that I think the Pats, it's just like all the shaky drafts that they had came back to haunt them. You know, at that fourth quarter, Ocho Cinco's on the left side, and the safety's not even looking at him. And it's just the corner's on an island with him, Brady's not even looking at him, and he has the whole left side of the field to run, and never threw one pass to him. But, you know, that was an Achilles heel for that Pats team. Gronkowski was the guy that stretched the defense. Once he got taken out, that's it.
Aaron Hernandez is pretty good, too.
Right, and that was it. And then they realized, all right, well, they took him out of the game. I think they double-teamed him in the second half, right? Most of the time?
Probably. You know, my feeling going into the game was the way the Giants played in the first game was a lot of post-safety defense, which means they had an extra player down the box. New England wasn't going to be able to run the ball very effectively. They were going to cloud up the middle of the field in between the hashes, which they did again, and where you have to win is outside. And... you know, it was a lot of the same in the Super Bowl. I mean, that's how they played in the first game. That's how they played in the second game. Yeah, to have a high-powered receiver, it's a good thing.
All right, so Mike Wallace costs a first-round pick this year and a conditional third that could become a second if the Patriots win a Super Bowl. And that's what it would cost to get him. Am I crazy, or with the Patriots, should they do that in a millisecond?
This is a pretty deep class of free agent wide receivers, so you might be able to look at a lot of those different guys.
But I could get Mike Wallace. I know Mike Wallace is good. Our guy Bill Barnwell and Grantland broke it down. Like his stats with Roethlisberger, he's basically 120 yards a game or something, and is the best deep threat in the league.
Okay, but it's,
he's 25.
It's not just good. Is he good for you?
Yes, he's good for us.
No, that's another.
My answer is yes.
But that's another part of the philosophy is that oftentimes in the draft, you're going to say this player is a good player, but he's not good for us. So the key thing for New England.
Like Donald Hayes is a good example.
Or any other team is, okay, he's a good player. He's just not good for us. So you're not discounting his value. So the key thing is Mike Wallace good for New England?
Yes.
And part of that is figuring out, you know, where is he from a ability to pick up scheme? That's so important because it's going to be a lot of no huddle. They're going to have to understand how the protection works, how the sight adjust and hops work.
I hate when you come back with logic.
No, but that's how it is. Otherwise, you're going to sit here and say you go get some guy, you know, player X. Who can't pick up the scheme?
Donald Hayes.
Then we're gonna be sitting here going, well, why didn't he work out?
Right.
He was over on that left-hand side, and the safety didn't even look at him.
Yeah.
So you need the guy that's good. That's what makes Deion Branch so good.
Yeah.
That's what makes Wes Welker so good, is not only do they understand the scheme, the offensive approach, they understand what the defense is doing.
And where to go because that guy's here and this
right.
guy's
he's
shading
with
this
the
way.
Outside
oh,
leverage,
that means
so
I went to the spot.
I'm going to break with inside
That's
leverage.
That's why that famous Welker play, and I was sitting in the seat, I wrote about this. You could see it. It was going to break at the line of scrimmage. You could see it. He saw some inefficiency. He saw this guy was over here too far and this cornerback was coming this way. And he just had that air and he saw it and he ran toward it. And Brady threw it a half second too early and he lofted it too high. He just had a straight throw. It would have been a 30-yarder.
Yeah, I mean, based on what I saw in films, it looked like it was three deep. It looked like he was running a seam route just inside the numbers. It looked like the safety was shading over further than normally would.
Yeah.
So the corner jumped up on the shallow route, which he shouldn't have.
Right.
So now Tom had a lot of space to throw to the outside. It didn't make any sense to throw a tight throw he was trying to throw him into the space.
That's the thing, he had the tight throw. If he had thrown it toward the sideline tight, Welker just goes and catches it and he goes down the sideline.
But you're not criticizing Tom's decision making, are you?
I am criticizing the fact that the play did not work out.
I know, but
I think if he had that throw again, he throws it differently.
Okay, I think Wes Welker is going to catch 19 out of 20 of those.
Yeah.
Sometimes it happens. And
I guess the thing
is, has there been a more reliable receiver in the last however many years?
It was a really tough catch. It was right in front of me.
I know.
Catch with shoulder pads and go over your head like that, falling backwards, everybody makes that catch.
I know. He's made a lot of them, though.
Let's say he
catches 121 of them last year?
Everyone in Boston blamed Welker, and I think it was a 50-50 thing.
Well, look, that was one play. There's a lot of other plays in that game you can look to that say, hey, if we had done this, this would have happened.
Well, the third down play nobody talks about. He threw it a little behind Deion, but Deion still could have. It was like third and 11.
Yeah,
there was another drop on the final drive. Yeah,
like those plays.
The Pats fell apart.
And defensively, you know, there were plays that could have been made. To say one guy, it's his fault, that's not fair.
If Welker caught it, he gets tackled at 15, maybe the Giants stop him, we kick a field goal, and Eli still has enough time.
Well, what if Mario Manningham doesn't make the catch he makes?
It was a great catch. That's basically what it came down to, was those two plays.
But what I'm just saying is, okay, Mario Manningham doesn't make that catch.
You mean future New England Patriot Mario Manningham?
I mean, is he right for
Mike
you?
Mike Wallace, Mario Manningham, Wes Welker. We're ready. 16-0. Last thing, because we're at the Sloan Conference. Analytics. You used a lot of analytics with the Jets and the Browns. You feel like it's a flawed, to some degree, area that has value and yet can be overrated. Like, explain your thought process on it.
No, I think it has real value. I think it has significant value. I think what happens is that the league, NFL, I think, is behind other sports in terms of incorporating analytics as a department, as a part of the process. And you get into this pattern of things that you have to achieve during the course of the season that there's not a lot of money spent and a lot of time spent on research and development. And I think that's an area that teams should do so much more in.
Especially with how much money they make. Just throw $5 million at your analytics.
We did a bunch of stuff in New York on performance enhancement, which is mental training based on the model they set up at West Point. And we were the only other team besides AC Milan to have a performance enhancement center. And all the time we talked to our athletes about move on to the next play. Make sure you envision this, be in a zone, all those different things. We always talk about it, but nobody teaches it.
Yeah.
Nobody teaches the athlete how to move on to the next play.
That's interesting.
Nobody teaches the athlete how to get into a zone. And there's a whole new field based on mental training using biometrics, to me, which I think is the wave of the future, because it's like anything else. I'm sure the first people that incorporated strength and conditioning, everybody's like, well, what are they doing that for? But as you lift weights, you see your muscles get bigger. The reason I like performance enhancement through biometrics is you get to see how your body is responding, whether it's heart coherence or looking at brain cortexes. This is like an emerging field, I think, that has a lot of value, but it's going to take time to make it football specific. They do a ton of it with special forces right now. And
can they teach fans how to get over heartbreaking losses? I'm willing to be a test case.
I think that's
at some point I need to stop thinking about Super Bowl 46.
Yeah, at some point you're going to have to, and that'll probably
can they work on my brain cortex?
We're going to have to do a lot of work, just judging by our conversation. I'm just glad you got over our relationship that I didn't know was in peril.
Yeah, well, you're a good dude. We're okay.
Good.
We've
good.
Moved on.
All right.
Plus, the Giants won that year anyway, so they legitimately won the game. I actually think more about the 06 Colts game.
Really?
It's 3rd and 3. That's it. Brady, Detroit, Brown, 3rd and 3. That's it. The Patriots should win that game. And
so
it's
you've got your one play from that game.
Oh, yeah.
You got the one play from the Super Bowl.
How about Ben Watson tackling Champ Bailey and the ref can't decide whether it went over the cone or not? And if we get that call and it's a touchback, I still think we win that game.
Yeah, I think it went over the cone, too.
And then the obviously the helmet catch was the worst of all of them, which the 14 holdings that were on. Now the Giant fans are complaining about there was a holding penalty right before the Pats got the ball back in SB 46 in the corner. I think it was Manningham, actually. And they are all saying, if you got it, that would have been the payback for the helmet catch if you had gotten that non-call.
But don't you think the Raiders fans are going to complain for life about the call they got? And you know,
all I can say is that call was interpreted correctly by the officials on hand.
Yeah, because you live here. If you live there, you may feel totally – that's like – I'm sure the Denver fans feel that official made the right rule.
They can go to hell. Eric Mangini, I'm sure we'll see you on our networks breaking down RG3 and Andrew Luck and Justin Blackmon.
And the whole crew.
Talking in hypotheticals, even though you don't like it. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Target the channel. Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.